everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your co-host, semi-professional Gibbon Wrangler, part-time Mark Bigney, and with me is the pro bono amateur smoke show full-time Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Fantastic. We're back. We had a week off. We're here with a whole slate of games to talk about.
I have emerged from the sickbed of COVID. I can attest that even when vaccinated, it will still kick your ass, but there's work to be done, Walker. It's time to get back to work.
Yep.
And so we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about what we reviewed last year in our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Aeurus. We're going to talk about the many, many games we've played over the course of the past 2 weeks. And then we're going to close it out with some news and why it doesn't matter. And that is going to be it for this week. But don't worry, you're going to get your full dose of swag. 100% swag. No filler. All killer. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly. 1 year ago.
See, that's filler. When you're elaborating, so you're exactly. drawing it out, right. Walker. You're yeah, just drawing exactly. it out, right? So we need to be pithy. When I say it's time for the years, we do the years. No prevarications, no delay, no equivocation. You need to get to it immediately and with no wasted breath.
Wow.
So get on with it.
The Great Wall.
Yes,
we reviewed The Great Wall. It was a Awakened Realms monstrosity crowdfunding game.
That. But not in their typical Awakened Realms fashion, right? For it was still nonetheless a euro. It was a monstrosity of a euro. But when you compare it to things like Nemesis or Tainted Grail or things like that, it was very, very constrained in comparison as far as crowdfunding is concerned.
And I believe we looked at it with a good light. We're keeping it, and we've played it since. And it's a worker placement where you're attacking stuff that is coming up to the wall. We're waiting for the alien expansion, which I'm sure is bound to come.
That might undercut the sort of historical theming a little bit.
I watched the movie, Mark. They're there.
Oh, okay. I need to see more documentaries.
The Great Wall.
Haven't gotten it to the table quite as much as we would like to. It's a little bit of a bear to teach in comparison to some of the other perennial Euros. So like, we've got some medium-heavy Euros that we like to bring out every once in a while. And I think The Great Wall, we played like once or twice since we reviewed it. And yeah, it's going to stay in our collection. I don't know why it is the case that I find it a little bit hard to bring it out. It's a little bit longer than some of the alternatives. When comparing it to a game like Revive, for example. I think I like Revive more than the rest of you people do, but nonetheless, it's something that we play every now and then. Some of the Uwe Rosenberg games definitely fall into that category as well. So it's good to have some of, you know, the proven medium-heavy Euros that make it out every once in a while. I'd be happier if, frankly, if we got to play The Great Wall more often, but...
Do they try to tag semi-co-op onto The Great Wall?
There's a whole bunch of modules. And I think actually one of the reasons why we haven't been playing, now that you mention it, most of the modules we've tried have been disappointing. We tried the co-op module once. I don't think you were at that game. And it was very unpleasant. We did not enjoy
the co-op.
I
did play it
version.
Once.
Oh, okay.
No, but I mean, just the regular game, I think they could almost sneak in a semi-co-op tag on it. Because you're all attacking the same enemies. And then there's that interesting interactive worker placement spots, like the
That's
more
true.
People that go there. So I'm just wondering if that...
Yeah, I don't know. So semi-co-op has a whole bunch of connotations, and I agree with you that understanding of semi-co-op is a legitimate one. I think that generally speaking, when people hear that, they think of either 1v-all or trader mechanisms. I think this is just an opportunity, not even necessarily for collusion. There's not really collusive aspects to The Great Wall, but there's aspects of dovetailing or profiting off of the actions of other people. So it's just the way the player interaction shakes out in The Great Wall is kind of sort of towards a shared goal of mutual benefit, by and large. So yes, in that sense, I would say it's a semi-co-op, indeed.
That is The Great Wall, the game reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now on to all of the games we played in the last 2 weeks. Mark played a great game called Don't Rock the Croc by Fox Mind. No designer credit, no illustrator credit. Now, the box says 3+.
Okay. Age or players?
For age. I played it with my granddaughter, who is a mere 1 year of age.
Walker, can we address this right off the bat?
Yes.
I just need to address this.
We sure can.
Okay. There are a few behaviors more obnoxious.
No, it's not going to happen.
Okay.
Definitely not.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
But
just to flag to the listeners, there's a few behaviors more obnoxious than the person who shows up on board game and says, I played Kalis with my 3-year-old. No. I don't see why people say it's so hard.
No.
I was playing Barrage with my 6-month-old. It's like,
I thought you were going to go to another thing, which I'm totally going to hit on.
All right.
But anyway, it says 3+, but it's mostly you roll a colored die.
Uh-huh.
You take a cylinder of that color and you place it on the crocodile. It's very much like Animal Spawn Animal.
Oh, okay.
Except it's a bunch of cylinders and the crocodile is sort of shaped in this, you know, U-shape thing, and they sort of all fall into this well and you try not to. And she was doing that, obviously, because she's a genius, right? So she would roll the dice.
And
that's the behavior. Right?
Yeah.
So she'd roll the die, see the color, pick the right cylinder of the color, and put it on the croc. Very quickly turned into much funner game if you flip the croc over and use the croc as a slide and slide the cylinders down, which I promoted that much because
sure.
She enjoyed that much better. But anyway, Don't Rock the Croc is a great game. There's bunch of different sizes of cylinder. And like I said, you're rolling the dice. It's very much a, you know, animal upon animal game.
Right, but all you need to do is match colors. And that's the only ability that's required. You don't even need to know what the colors are called. You just need to be able to correspond to them. Yeah.
So it was a great experience.
And I say that would probably be helpful for you because your vocabulary is that of a 2-year-old. So
exactly.
Yeah. All right.
She kicked my butt.
Well, it says here that it's a 1-player game. So.
Does it really?
Yeah. Honestly, the Board Game Geek entry for Don't Rock the Croc is very sparse. It doesn't even have a year attached to
it.
Let alone designer.
That's what I mean. Well, I believe I found it at Walmart. It was like $10. And
sure.
I looked at it, it says all wooden parts for $10, a dexterity game.
Yeah.
How can you go wrong?
Oh, it looks legit.
Yeah.
I mean, I would play this, but it says on Board Game Geek that it's a 1-player game. So did you read the rules?
No.
Okay, yeah. I think this is one of those other... I think, Walker, I've been meaning to have this talk with you, and the fact that it has to happen on air is somewhat embarrassing, but nonetheless illustrative. I think when you play a game not having read the rules, you should say something about that.
Gotcha.
Okay. So maybe it is just, in theory, intended to be a 1-player game, but of course you can play it.
Yes.
Obviously, the way it works multiplayer is obviously you just import the animal upon animal rules, and there you go. So that was Don't Rock the Croc. Not about fashion.
No.
But that is definitely a point of advice. Never rock the croc.
No. That would be bad.
It would be bad. I got to play War Story Occupied France. This is long overdue. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is by David Neal and David Thompson. David Thompson being probably one of the foremost solo designers working today. And we're a big fan of many, many of his works. And I commented as a joke a few years ago that David Thompson, since he collaborates so profusely with a lot of different designers of great talent, Trevor Benjamin most frequently, but Jeff Engelstein and Roger Tankersley and a whole bunch of other people who are very talented designers in their own rights, I wanted to see what he would do in a collaboration with Nikki Valens, because Nikki Valens is one of the best at making narrative-style games, you know, the paragraph, choose-your-own-adventure-style thing, particularly Legacy of Dragonholt, which I think is the definitive game of that genre, certainly of the fantasy-adventure version. And David Thompson is a master of interesting solo mechanisms, and so what a slightly more robust solo game with the narrative quality of Nikki Valens' design chops and a slightly more solo wargamer-ish mechanical vibe of David Thompson would be truly something impressive. This has not come to pass, but I keep mentioning it in the form of wish casting, which is no slight against Dave Neal. This war story is really interesting, but I would say that it is not primarily interesting from a narrative perspective. So it comes with 3 scenarios, and they're all about the Maquisards in the French Resistance during World War II. And what you do is you make a squad of resistance members, and they all have their own personnel files, and their names are French AF, which I very much appreciate, but they're nothing more than a list of stats. And since you're playing as a squad rather than an individual, you don't really get that added textural sense of character-driven narrative that I often got in Legacy of Dragonholt. And on top of that, the people that you interact with are not badly written or underwritten. It's just they're there and then they're gone. And so there's not really an opportunity for a lot of character stuff so far. Granted, this is scenario 1 of 3. What you get, though, is surprisingly interesting set pieces. At a couple of moments during the scenario, you're told to break out some maps, which are hidden behind envelopes, of course, And then you have to deploy your agents, decide who's doing what based on their equipment and their skills. And on top of that, there's some resource management of deciding when to cash in your chips and when to risk things and when to subject your agents to more mortal peril. And the game is very good at flagging the range of possible consequences. It's not that it was predictable, but things didn't come out of left field. And that's a difficult balance to tread. And I think that War Story Occupied France did an exceptional job of that. On top, what we get is kind of bespoke, vaguely wargamey mechanisms that kind of sneak their way into these little set pieces. And I was very, very pleased. Very simple, very straightforward to execute, but nonetheless very engaging and made me feel like I was doing more than I was ever doing in something like Legacy of Dragonhold from a mechanical end. So in that sense, my wish of seeing what David Thompson would do in a solo narrative paragraph-driven format has very much come to fruition. Does it have less character than some of the other ones? Absolutely, but that's okay. What it lacks in character, it makes up for in mechanical appeal as well as broader historical context. I mean, the setting does a lot of the work as well. I do have to stress something, and that is, and I'm of two minds about how to say this, so I'll say it both ways. The one way to say it, which is accurate, is that War Story Occupied France is unplayable out of the box. Another way to say it is there's a small list of errata. Both of these are accurate statements, but misleading. And so how hard a time you want to give to the publisher Osprey Games in this context is a little bit dicey. Now, one thing I will note is that Osprey has a pretty bad track record by now of errata and misprints. They've had their Imperium releases, the latest release of Undaunted, the Undaunted expansions. They've all been burdened with significant errata. And in the context of War Story Occupied France, which again is a paragraph-driven game, if it tells you to go to the wrong paragraph, as it does in scenario one, the scenario breaks. And I encountered this. So if you're going to play War Story Occupied France, and I recommend it if you're into solo paragraph-driven games, especially if you want to see how they can become very slightly more wargamey with these action set pieces, you have to check the errata before starting. It is absolutely 100% required. So that's my early experience with War Story Occupied France. I do intend to go and check out the next scenario, but normally in cases like this, it would be because I wanted to see what happened next, or I wanted to see what happened with the characters. Again, that is not what's driving me in War Story Occupied France. I'm more interested in seeing how the design elaborates and how they use the mechanical structure to do more with this than has been done. Because frankly, you know, going back to the originals like Tales of the Arabian Nights, there hasn't been a lot of mechanical innovation in the sphere of the paragraph-driven thing, which is fine. It's not designed to be a mechanical experience. But I'm very pleased with all the cool little bits that I got to do in War Story Occupied France, and that's what's driving me into the next scenario, not a sense of narrative or adventure or character. And that's where I'm sitting with that.
So, you know, I got to play Barcelona back to the table again, and we played with the new big expansion, which is Passage de Garcia, or Gracia? Who knows?
It's Gracia.
Gracia. All right, so what you do in Barcelona is you place some civilians on an empty space on this large Barcelona map, and then wherever the axes correspond are all the actions you can do. If you put it down the center sort of diagonal line, then you can do up to three. So what this expansion does is it takes two of what would be called, you know, framed by the self-proclaimed Alpha Gamer, the most boring actions.
I'm with him on this one. Alpha Gamer's entirely right. There are actions that do things, and then there are actions that just get your resources. And the Gracia actions replace the ones that just give you resources, and so it's more interesting.
So now what you're doing, instead of just getting the, you know, boring action of just getting resources, now you're traversing in two different directions on this sort of roadmap as you're doing other actions to increase the die that you're using as your movement token to go up these roads. That's the joy factor of the civilians walking along the road, because you want to get up to six by the time it reaches the end of the road, because then you get more points and more benefits.
So the way it works is there are two parallel tracks going in different directions, and your die starts at one, and it can move along the various spots. And as it lands on a spot, you ask yourself, has it met the prerequisite of this spot? If yes, it ticks up by one. If not, it doesn't. So it's theoretically possible to march your die all the way to the end and it stays at one, in which case you don't really get anything. Or if you've met all of the prerequisites, that's going to tick it up by three numbers. And then there are other ways to tick it up as well. Not going to go into all the details.
Well, the one is great, though, because you can wave across at your other die if you finish the movement.
If you land in a space where your other die is on the other track, they both go up by one, which means, I mean, it's relevant for tempo, because if you advance one of your dice and just let it sit there for a while and you're pumping the other track reliably, that is a way to buff up that track. And you might want to do that because that other track is weak and you don't meet the prerequisites, or because it's strong and you want to get all the way to six. Because if you get all the way to the end of the track with a full six, it's hard. It usually takes some time, but it's worth a fair whack of points.
Yeah, 15 points.
Yeah.
So overall, I put it in the main box. I will not play without it, because like we said, it takes away those boring actions. And I feel Barcelona, and I'm glad we got it back to the table. I really do enjoy playing it. There's a lot going on. It's a combo-tastic type game, but you have to work for it. You have to be able to see the board, see where the combos are, and how it's going to impact your particular game. I like how you can plan ahead for all the different scoring objectives, and you can sort of work towards those scoring objectives. I don't know. How'd you like getting Barcelona back to the table?
There's a lot that I like, and then I remembered a lot that I don't like quite as much Barcelona. Barcelona is fine. It's pretty good. I do agree that as far as combo-tastic Euros go, and this feels very much like a game that Stefan Feld would love, it's very much in his of point salad, and almost everything you do gets you a fair number of points. And the difference is going to be the person who reliably gets more points on their turn as opposed to the people who reliably get fewer points. But you do get to do things like setting up your own endgame victory requirements. And that can be a lot of points or not, case depending. It's a point salad game. You can't do a little bit of everything. The one thing that I don't enjoy about Barcelona is that I really feel like this mild element of luck of the draw of which color citizens you pull can be very consequential, because a lot of your points, often the lion's share, not necessarily, but often the lion's share, is going to be what buildings you're able to build. And unlike almost every other Euro, you get to build for free. It just happens. It just arrives. But it's a function of where other citizens were left on the map, where other people put their workers. And this influences two things. Number one, I often felt that the smartest play were just purely reactive off of where other people went. It wasn't super restrictive. It just made me feel like the obvious path was being presented to me, and it kind of constrained this universe of interesting levers for me to pull. And so I often felt that on my turn, I basically had like two or three choices that made sense, and I could go and stick to my plan or go and do something else, but that would just be leaving too many points on the table and handing those same points to somebody else downstream. So obviously the pressures were significant. And number two, as the game goes on, especially if you're playing with four, the map gets more and more constrained. And so your ability to build, number one, the incentive goes up because buildings were worth more and more and more points as the game goes on. And number two, in order to build, you need to be able to build the right kind of building, which is a function of pulling the right colored chit from the bag. And so there were been occasions, not this game because we played with three, but I was reminded there would be situations where sometimes it was the difference between being able to build and not being able to build at all. In the game we played, it was the difference between being able to build the building I wanted and being able to build something else. So we're talking about a marginal difference of, say, 30% of the points on a turn, as opposed to the difference of, say, 20 points on a turn, which it can be in other contexts. Yeah. That's not ideal. It's still really short. It's clever. I really like the expansion. Barcelona is already a game with mechanisms upon mechanisms. None of them are complicated, but there's a lot of different things to worry about. You've got the trolleys and the buildings and the other kind of buildings and the other kind of buildings and the victory conditions and upgrading the victory conditions and putting out the roads. So honestly, putting on one more thing, sometimes one more thing is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and sometimes one more thing, it fits right in. And in this context, I honestly felt that the Passage de Gracia fit in really kind of neatly, because it was all about other things that you were already building, right? Like this prerequisite for this path is these other things that you're doing anyway. So it kind of integrated things in a slightly better way than a lot of the other mechanisms that felt more free-floating. So I'm not going to say that it made it more coherent, but it definitely didn't sprawl it too much.
Yeah, it was just something that you got to do as well as what you're going to do normally, which is nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And given that, as I say, most of the time I find that my placements are dictated by the lay of the board, it ends up feeling very tactical a lot of the time. despite the fact that a lot of the victory conditions encourage you to think strategically. Sometimes that's good tension. In the context of Barcelona, I don't think it's good tension. I think it's mostly that it's not that the game plays itself, but it's a little more on guardrails than I would like.
Yeah, a couple times it felt a little Gaia Project to me. It was like, okay, I really need a coin, but how can I get a coin? It's like, well, if I do this action and then this dovetails over to this action, it'll let me tick this die up twice, which will allow me to do this other action, will let me advance that die, and then I'll get the gold coin that I wanted, and then I can do, yeah. Anyway.
And frequently, given how point salad it is, you think, oh, and that gives me 7 points. Oh, and that other there gives me 2 more. Oh, okay, this is great. So,
well, of course, as you go along.
Yeah.
Points, 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 points. That is Barcelona by Danny Garcia and put out by Board and Dice Games.
Got to play Mass Effect the board game Priority Hagalaz. I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce it. This is designed by Eric Lang and Calvin Wong Seilun. This is a pure co-op by Modiphius Entertainment. Right off the top, I was a little disappointed because it has one of the things that a lot of co-ops have, which I don't like, which is a fixed player count. So it's a fixed player count of 4 players. One player plays as Commander Shepard from the Mass Effect video game, and then there are 3 more squad mates. And so if you're playing with 3, as we often are, it's a little awkward. So really, you want to play with 1, 2, or 4 players, broadly speaking. On top of that, I don't know to what extent this is because I'm a longtime fan of the Mass Effect franchise, but as a squad-based tactical combat thing, I couldn't help but feel that it was undercut by the fact that some of the characters just seemed really at odds with how they were in the video game. So, for example, in the video game, Garrus Vakarian is something of a crackshot murderer. And Liara Tassoni, on the other hand, is more of a support character. But in the board game, Liara Tassoni is the one who's shooting people for tremendous quantities of damage. And it's Garrus in our game that we had a great deal of difficulty getting him off the ground at all. On top of that, Commander Shepard felt really weak. Anyway, though that's quibbling around the margins. That's just thematic integration stuff. It is a deterministic action-based game, so your shots necessarily do the same amount of damage. There's no random allocation of damage or success or failure. What you do is you're drafting dice from a pool based on where you are in the player order. So the start player picks up all 12 action dice, rolls them, take any 3. And then the next player picks up the remaining 9, rolls them, and picks any 3 from there. And so gradually the options go down. This can sometimes lead to very unsatisfying turns, on top of the fact that the first scenario we played was a very constrained map, and anytime you leave contact with an enemy, they do their full attack value to you in damage. So those two things together meant that we often had a lot of reasons not to go anywhere or do anything, which was not satisfying. And then on top of that, there's the fact that the spawn rate is really high. So you might say, okay, well, you don't want to leave engagement with an enemy because they're going to do their full damage. So why don't you just take them out and then next turn or later or whatever, you then might be able to move on to the mission objective. Well, here's the problem. So you're engaged with somebody. You spent your turn eliminating them. You then pull the AI card. And the AI cards very frequently say spawn a new enemy at the closest unoccupied spawn point. Not the farthest, but the closest. Sometimes it's the farthest, but most of the time it's the closest. So often, very often, we'd spend our turn being like, well, I can't leave, that would kill me, so I guess I'll eliminate this enemy. Oh, it spawns again. All right, that was great. That was a turn.
Don't engage with enemies that are right beside their spawn points.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, if the map is sufficiently constrained, it's a little awkward. So we were somewhat displeased by the overall pacing of the Mass Effect board game. We didn't think that the characters were particularly evocative of how they felt in the video game as far as their strengths are concerned. So there were a couple of Mass Effect fans and a Mass Effect newbie. None of us were particularly grabbed, but we're going to give it another couple scenarios, partially because of our enthusiasm of the source material and also because it's relatively quick and brisk. And even though it feels very sluggish in terms of what you're actually doing, the overall structure of the missions isn't particularly burdensome. So we're going to give it a little bit more rope. Now, all of that having been said, let's talk about the fact that it's been review bombed on BoardGameGeek. People get to review things however they want. I'm not going to touch that. I don't know. I don't care. I'm also not going to tone police Eric Lang's response to the review bombing. But the substantive issue at the heart of the review bombing for Mass Effect Priority Hagalaz was that on the character sheets, there are the preferred pronouns of the individual character on the sheets. It doesn't say preferred pronouns, it just says what the pronouns are. I think there is a micro level to address this and a macro level. On a micro level, Mark, as a consumer, thinks very sincerely that all science fiction games should have pronouns listed for aliens.
Well, plus I don't understand what the problem is, because I just, because of, we were talking about it, I decided, because you can get, what is it called? Is it Legacy Edition? The new Mass Effect game that has everything.
Legendary Edition.
You can get the Legendary Edition. I grab the Legendary Edition, and that's the first thing you do when you start the game. Do you want to play as the female Shepard or the male Shepard? And so the card lets you choose which it's going to be.
Well, I think people are more upset about the fact that there is a picture of someone female presenting, and then there are pronouns on top of that. Look, I can't crawl too deep into the mindset of these. But look, I just think about what it is to be a user, and I play games like Project Elite, right? And I see these aliens. I'm like, I sincerely don't want, as a consumer and as a gamer, to then start speculating about, like, well, do they have visible hips? Does it look like they have breasts? I don't know. That's just awkward. Like, why would, it's much simpler in a science fiction context, especially, to just list the preferred pronouns of these aliens. I could line up 10 Krogan in front of you, Walker, and you would not be able to identify which Krogan are male and which Krogan are female. So, pronouns are helpful in that sense, and if there's any venue in which it makes perfect sense, it's science fiction, all right? The other thing on a macro level, I would just say, I know people who are non-binary and trans, and it costs us nothing to put pronouns on things. And yes, it's signaling, but what it's signaling is that we are trying in the board game space to make this more accommodating for people of non-traditional or non-standard gender expression. And if that alienates or frightens you, I try to be sympathetic, but I can't agree with your position that obviously makes the product alienating to you or frightening or angry making. Get over it. I think that when it comes time to express our sympathies, we have to recognize the fact that this of all times is time to speak the truth and protect the vulnerable, and I know where my allegiances lie in that context. And when we talk about growing the hobby, we don't necessarily mean in terms of sheer numbers. What we're actually talking about is making the hobby a welcoming and safe space, especially for vulnerable people. And that is my two cents, and so that is my comment on the situation of pronouns in Mass Effect the Board Game Priority Hagalaz, mostly, which is to say, I think it is helpful as a personal user, and I think it is helpful broadly for the community. Designed by Eric Lang and Calvin Wong Tse-Loon, published by Modiphius Entertainment, the base game comes with 5 miniatures, namely 1 miniature for each of the characters. If you want to give them many, many hundreds of dollars, you can get resin versions of everything, but I have not gone that far into it.
So I'm going to bring up another game that maybe has the same sort of faults in it. So we just finished playing another game of Freedom 5. And the same thing, Court of Fight, you know, slog across the map to take care of, you know, fires, only to have the fires just flare up again in random spots. Yep. Unlike this is a very pandemic type game where the same sort of thing, enough people show up, they explode, you know, fight all the fires that are not literal fires, but problems that are all over, try to reduce it down so they don't explode. But unlike pandemic, where you can sort of, you sort of know where the fires are going to happen, you don't see that here. It's completely random. Luckily, I played a character that very much helped with our movement problem from the last game, but still the fact that it was just all over the board and you only have 5 actions, and any sort of injury usually reduces those number of actions. And like Mark, we talked about just before, the primary difference is when you deal with problems in pandemic, all you need is the cards. You play the cards and the problem is dealt with. What this layers on top of it is that you play the cards and now you have to roll dice. So now yet another random element is thrown on top of everything else. And it just makes a game that potentially could be very good. Theme is great. That pandemic style almost always works out in all the games that's been put into. We didn't even finish because we were already at the 2-hour mark and it just got so sloggy that it was painful.
Well, what happens is, like pandemic, you spend some time gathering the necessary cards to try to advance the victory conditions. In the context of Freedom 5, it's attacking a villain or a mastermind. In order to do that, you have to build your dice pool by playing enough cards with dice on them, and that gives you the dice you get to roll. And then you roll the test. And typically there's a fair bunch of shenanigans involved, such that you don't want to have more than one combat encounter because they frequently heal themselves after an unsuccessful combat encounter. And by unsuccessful, I mean one that doesn't put them down. And so on top of this, there's the random villain movement. They're just popping off all over around the map. And so you have to take advantage of the opportunities you can of getting everyone in the same place when they have what you think is an appropriate number of cards. And then we rolled poorly. And if you roll poorly, and this is after several rerolls, I still rolled below the expected probabilistic result. And so consequently, what should have been a successful combat encounter ended up with a wounded villain. You say, oh, okay, well, just do another and finish them off. Two problems. Number one, they went off and healed themselves. And number two, we've spent all our cards. So now what we have to do is spend however many rounds after this, just slowly, laboriously gathering more cards so we can then try to get to the same place again, try to make sure that the villain doesn't move out from under us again, dealing with these ridiculous wounds that always need to...
While at the same time chasing around all the henchmen that are building up.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, those are the things we do in the interim. And all of these are reasons not to play cards, and the cards are the interesting part anyway. I would also, for what it's worth, Walker, issue one minor emendation to your observation that you think it's well-themed. I think the art is well done. I think the graphic design is well done. I think the pieces are really cool for the most part. The problem is I don't feel like a superhero. I don't get that sort of power fantasy, superheroic
The window dressing theme, whether they implemented the theme well or not.
Exactly.
Definitely we can have a discussion on that. But.
And I respect, it's just so often the case that superhero games end up leaning on all these tedious movement problems that we often find in games of this ilk, where you spend so much of your turn just getting to the other side of the map, just to deal with the thing that sprouted up there completely arbitrarily. And that doesn't make me feel superheroic. I mean, imagine an entire episode of the X-Men where they're just like killing time on the Blackbird or something. It's like, oh, geez. Oh, and there's turbulence. It's like, okay, we got to make a detour now. It's like, all right.
Yeah, now there's a bathroom break. Wait.
Yeah, yeah. X-Men layover in Dulles Airport. Seriously, it's just, you spent all your time. Movement can be fun. Movement can be well done. It's just I often find in superhero games it's not very well done. And so in the context of Freedom 5, with a couple of minor exceptions, it's just this weird map of random problems showing up randomly, and it's just a slog and on the more randomness to deal with the problems later on. Ugh. Sign me off. I'm just out. So that's Freedom 5, a Sentinel Comics board game. Stick to Pandemic. Stick to Sentinels of the Multiverse. Designed by Richard Lanius, who designed Defenders of the Realm, of which this is a riff. Adam Sadler and Brady Sadler, published by Arcane Wonders this year after successful crowdfunding and after I gave them far, far too much money.
Just a quick side note, it should be news, but since we're talking about Pandemic now, Z-Man Games have hinted around, but we have figured out that there's going to be an Iberian expansion to Iberian Pandemic. Those fans...
Pandemic Iberia, Iberian expansion?
Just so.
Yeah. Pandemic Iberia is really good.
So I've heard.
Got to play Behold Rome. Behold Rome is a review copy we got from the designer. It is a solo game by Joe Klipfel. Joe Klipfel is the one who designed Gloomholden, the iconoclastic, solo, single-handed kind of sort of Gloomhaven thing that became Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs. And Behold Rome is kind of that same design idiom as applied to within striking distance of the Imperium deck-building game as well as a Civ management card game. So, on the one hand, the rules can be difficult to grasp, and some of the details might slip through your fingers, but basically the game asks you to be alternately dexterous and sinister, because you're going mano-a-mano with a whole bunch of challenges, and so you need to manipulate your hand and manipulate the deck as you go through a white-knuckle challenge, and effectively the way that it works is you have in one hand your entire deck, you pull some cards, and every card has four versions, which is really the part that starts breaking my head open. You can upgrade cards, you can degrade cards. Sometimes they change type. The card that used to be an action card is now a territory for you to conquer. And so you might take a develop action to develop that action card into a territory and then use another card in your hand to conquer that territory. And then that slides behind you.
I was supposed to say, which turns into something else.
Which then might turn into something else, absolutely. And on top of this, there are four stages that Rome can go through. It starts out as progress through early empire into a theocracy if you want to go all the way. But you can stay as an early republic or at any stage you want because they all have their own victory conditions. And that's where things get truly daunting. Behold Rome is a very difficult game to play well because the victory conditions on all the cards start really interacting with all the other cards you have. So, for example, if you proceed to an imperial stage, you get more points for all of the localities that you've developed, essentially. These are kind of like tributaries. They're not locations that you've conquered. These are a new type. These are the people that give you tribute, even though you don't necessarily occupy them, right? And each of those cards might have their own victory conditions on them. and then all your other action cards that you're using to develop things into tributaries might have their own victory conditions as well that dovetail with other things. And so trying to keep all of this in check is a really, really interesting balancing act. So it's challenging just to get where you want to go, and on top of that, it's extra challenging to try to figure out how to maximize your victory conditions. Having only played it 1.5 times, I am in no position to say that I know what I'm doing, but I'm really enjoying exploring the decision space and the design space. It's extraordinarily well done. When I initially saw in the grand tradition of solo games that has a very small amount of action cards, I figured, oh, okay, well, this is going to be something. But as I say, each card has 4 versions, and they all have, the victory conditions are all over the place. And so it's very, very challenging to maximize these things, and you never, ever get anything for free. Everything costs a lot. Like, to get a resource, you typically have to play an action card and then burn something else in order to get the resource in question. And then to spend that resource, you typically need to play some other action and burn something else and degrade a card somewhere else. And it's really cool. Just one more detail to emphasize how interesting things are. Some of your action cards start out fully upgraded, because, again, the costs of so many of the actions are to degrade cards. So, for example, you start with Sulla, and Sulla is a level 4 card. But and as you degrade him, you get to historical figures that happened later in Roman history after Sulla. And so he exists in that way to let you power these other abilities if you want. Or you could try to make sure that Sulla is in your deck at the end of the game, because Sulla has his own, guess what, victory conditions attached to him. So it's everything touches on everything else. It's extraordinarily well done. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I found it sufficiently taxing that I could only ever do like a couple turns at a time, but it's a single stack of cards. I just put it to the side of my desk, go do something else, and say, oh, let's check back in with Rome. And then I'd go and do another turns. It's really extraordinary as a solo experience. I highly recommend it. I had a great time with Behold Rome, and I will absolutely be going back to it.
So the stream this week, we did like a card game bonanza. So we played 4 different card games. First one being Rebel Princess. And so you get to play a princess, Mark, and you don't want to get betrothed. So you hate the prince cards.
I love it already.
It is great. And so it's one of these games where points are bad, negative points are good. And so there's a prince suit, and you can't lead with the prince suit until someone's thrown one away because they're void of the lead of that particular round. So as soon as someone's played the prince card out, then now you can start leading prince cards. And then you keep track of all your one tricks, and you get points for all the prince cards you have. And there's also a green suit that has a frog, of course.
Because, of course,
you know, there's the prince frog, and that's -5 points. Sorry, +5 points. So figuring out who's going to get this frog is fantastic as well. So it's this weird thing of, you know, nothing else really matters. So you're just, you know, getting ready for, you know, not winning princes, making sure that you don't leave yourself open to getting this frog card. And then you can also shoot the moon, Mark, which was done several times, mostly based on how people's hands, you know, at the beginning of the turn.
So what's the thematic explanation for what happens when you get all the princes?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'll have to look it up.
Okay.
So if you get all of the princes and the frog card, then that's -15 points.
Nice.
I was just one frog short. Because I think that's pretty well how you should have to play that. I think you try to lure yourself to get the frog early, and then, you know, because you've got dealt a bunch of princes, or you think you can take a bunch, then go for the rest of the princes. Like, don't make your move with the frog card out there, because they can easily deny you that frog card.
Yeah, you got to play the table. You got to be a real spin doctor when 2 princes lay before you.
So I really enjoyed it. Glad I have it. Can't wait to show it to you. That is Rebel Princesses. This is designed by Daniel Breen, Jose Giraldo, Kevin Prez, and Tristo Vigos. You get dealt 2 princesses. Every player gets dealt 2, and you choose one. They have a special ability that you get to play every round. It's a great little game.
So you get 2 rebels, so it's rebel.
Rebel, rebel.
Is their face a mess? Did they tear their dress?
No, they got cheeseburgers. Rebel, rebel, rebel.
Oh, okay.
I'll talk about the other one that you didn't get to play yet, and that's called Sears Catalog, which is a play on words, and I thought it's fantastic. Because it's Sears, as in, you know, Sears.
Right.
Catalog.
Those that see.
So, and of course, the cover is right out of a Sears catalog, but, you know, has things in the background.
That's brilliant.
It is quite brilliant. This is designed by Taylor Reiner and put out by Bezier Games. And unfortunately, it feels as though they took Scout and said, how can we make this unfun and unplayable?
Mm.
It plays very much like Scout, except you can move cards around in your hand as you see fit. And it goes around the table, someone plays triples, and you got to play a higher triples, and it keeps going around until no one can play. And then on top of that, they threw in these crazy... Everyone gets dealt two artifact cards at the beginning of every round that just totally break the rules in some way. Like, there was an oracle that let you play... like sets that normally couldn't be played. Like, here's a run of prime numbers. Then everyone has to play a higher run of prime numbers, or
just
anything weird like that.
Sure.
And just things that, you know, we were constantly looking in the book, trying to figure out how they worked.
Mm.
And we all sort of just said, well, why wouldn't we just play Scout? And because some people really like those crazy chaotic cards. And so if you thought Scout was boring and you like chaos and weird cards, then maybe Sears Catalog is for you. It was not for me.
And now a brief break to pay some bills.
Now on to a couple games that card games that you and I have also played together. Let's talk about the Gang first, because that is the weirdest one of all. I was sold the Gang when it was first announced, because it said it was a cooperative Texas Hold'em poker game. And it 100% delivers on that. You, at every step of Texas Hold'em, everyone's going to take a numbered chip, one through how many players
there are. Yeah, instead of bidding rounds, there are these rounds where players take chips to try to communicate to the rest of the table where they think their hand will rank compared to everyone else.
And for those that don't know Texas Hold'em, it's mostly based off the fact that there's community cards that everyone gets to use. So it is possible that everyone's just using the five cards that end up at the end of the round in the middle, because they're the best five. So you get your first two cards and you're going to take a chip. Then you get what's called the flop, which is three face-up cards, and then you're going to take a chip. And then you get the turn, and then you get the river. So eventually five cards are in the middle, and you're taking these chips to sort of signal. There's no talking allowed. You're taking these chips in order to signal to the other players how strong your hand is becoming. And then the very last round is really the round that matters. And you need to take exactly the order of, you know, the strength of hands of everyone. And then the first person will reveal their hand. If they're the lowest, then you just continue around and hopefully get them all right. Because you're allowed to have three bad rounds, or you lose the game, or until you get three good rounds.
Yeah, the goal is to get three rounds where everyone is exactly right before you get three rounds where anyone is wrong at all.
And I can see one of the players we played with had an issue with, well, what's the purpose of the first four rounds, and I can see where people might, you know, fall into that.
It's a little counterintuitive, but I think it serves an excellent purpose. I completely underestimated the extent to which there is substantive communication in the Gang. It reminds me a little bit, to a certain extent, of some of the magic that you get from some CMYK games like Wavelength or Wilmot's Warehouse. It was a situation where the premise was explained. I understood the structure of, like, this is impossible. This is not going to work. There are too many variables. How do I know what a good hand looks like? That's absurd. Like, sometimes a good hand is, it depends. Like, sometimes the best hand is going to be a pair. Sometimes the best hand is going to be a flush. Like, what are you talking about? And then after the first round, I was like, oh my goodness, this is starting to make sense. And it was just a marvelous moment of discovery and a little bit of shared magic at being able to make these inferences about, okay, well, they took a four on the first round. They thought they had the best hand of the table, but then it just kept going down. I guess they just got dealt a pocket pair. I guess that's what it meant. They started out crappy and it keeps getting better. Did they just draw into a straight? You know, stuff like that. It was really cool. I am so sick to death of using poker as a scoring metric. Like, I was even kind of tired of it a few years into Shot and Totten, for crying out loud, because a lot of card games use poker hands to resolve strength of a variety of things. But the Gang completely won me over. I was shocked by how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and depending on how much experience people have with Texas Hold'em, it'll be either really fast to teach or it'll still be relatively quick to teach. I'm so glad I opened up the box and it had the ranking of hands.
Yeah, because some people just don't.
On five cards that you just hand out. I was like, thank God, because I'd already prepared to have it up on, you know, a computer screen nearby.
Right,
because it's that essential part. But thank, you know, they have that there, because if you don't know, you know, I played a lot of Texas Hold'em. So, you know, you're losing
out. A lot of other dudes.
You're losing out on that, you know, sort of bluffing and, you know, all of that
stuff. It's an entirely different game.
It is, but I'm just saying, what I'm trying to get at is that if you have that kind of experience, you still can get just as much out of this by sort of seeing what other people are doing and just trying to figure out. And the talking afterwards is great as well. You know, you know, when I did this turn, I had this, and then you sort of talk out why you took certain numbers when you did. Anyway, the gang is designed by John Cooper and Corey Heath and put out by Cosmos Games. Play it anytime. Let's finish up with the fourth card game we played that Mark and I also played. It is called Flip 7. I'm sure you've heard about it. This is designed by Eric Olson and put out by OP Games.
Would you say it's the greatest card game of all time?
Well, it does. So
several times.
Who am I to object?
And I just want to stress, this is the kind of thing that strikes me as somebody who did metaphysics once upon a time. It doesn't say the best card game ever made, because that leaves open the possibility that there might be a subsequent future card game that surpasses it. This is the greatest card game of all time. So presumably, we might as well just all pack it in because nothing's going to match it.
It's true. I think it is allowed to brag a little. I think in what it tries to bring to the table, it gets to say that. It reduces...
Ooh, that, I was going to give it a pass just on the grounds of general marketing hyperbole.
It reduces,
I'm not going to give anyone a hard time. I was just playing with the words. But now you're going and trying to say that
saying,
there's some substance behind it. Woof.
It reduces push your luck down to its purest form in such a quick, plain, easy-to-teach game. I think it just does such a great job. Flip 7. Deck of cards numbered 0 through 12. And there are as many numbers of that card as the value. So 12 12s, 11 11s, all the way down to 1 1 and 1 0. When it's your turn, you either hit or pass. So you either take a card or you pass, and then you add up all the cards that are in front of you. That will be your score. Or you hit and you get another card. But if it matches any of the basic numbered cards that you have, then you've busted and you're out. There's all sorts of fancy action cards and modifier cards, but we will not get into that, but that is how I'm teaching it now. I simply shuffle the deck and start dealing them out, and I deal with those action cards and modified cards as they come up because they're that basic and, you know, moves that quickly. So it's either you're busting or you're hitting, and it instant teach, instant fun, Flip 7.
It's fine. I'm going to be against it. It's enjoyable, but I think that in terms of the purity of it as a push-your-luck experience, I think that the action cards are good for the game design and the game experience, but definitely undercut this idea that it's some kind of great distillation of some fundamental idea, right? It's a fine activity. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. I'm not, I highly doubt it'll be even close to any of my top 10 of this year even, or top 10 card games.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is, for what it says it's going to bring to the table, it does.
Yeah, in the sense of here's a fun little activity with effectively very low barrier to entry, and you can accommodate as many players as you want. The rulebook does say if you plan on playing with an excess of 18 people, you might want to get a second deck. But with that in mind, it's incredibly straightforward. But in terms of, you know, quality push-your-luck game design, I don't think this would even compete next to, like, Reiner Knizia's top 10 games with push-your-luck elements in them. That's all. Yeah.
Just for that one mechanism, like Reiner Knizia's push-your-luck will do that, and plus everything else that brings it up to that level. I just mean for that one particular thing.
I think we're quibbling over the margins here. I don't think that we substantively disagree. I just want to emphasize that this is closer to roll a six, win a cookie than something like even something as simple as Don't Llama Dice. That's effectively what I'm saying.
Gotcha.
I will play roll a six, win a cookie any damn day. Rolling dice is fun. Cookies are fun. Flipping over cards and seeing what happened can be fun. And indeed, Flip 7 leverages that. It there's a certain level of nonsense and randomness from card games. And at a certain point when designing Flip 7, they said, why don't we just put in some more? And that's the point where I'm saying, fine activity.
Gotcha.
But I don't think it's quite a pure manifestation of push your luck as you've been making it out to be. That's all I'm saying.
I think it'll be a great sort of family holiday game.
Totally.
Because it's so easy to teach. And that is Flip 7.
And it needs no space on the table, basically. I mean, just people need the three or four cards in front of them. That's about it.
And we hate the freeze card. Freeze card's garbage.
The freeze card is not fun. The freeze card just says, points somebody and says you're out.
Yeah, you don't get to play anymore.
Yeah, you're not playing in this round. Yeah, not great.
Especially when it comes out early. Oh, you got that one card?
Yeah.
You hit score point and you're out.
Yeah.
And those are all the four card games we played on stream. If you want to check any of them out, check it out. It's on our YouTube channel under the live tab. We had good fun.
Got to play Scholars of the South Tigris. This was recommended to us by Warm Boy. Warm Boy is a big Garfield fan, and he is sympathetic to the fact that thus far, Walker and I have not really enjoyed our Garfield games. And he said that Scholars of the South Tigris was worth, or Tigris, I don't know how to say that word, frankly, was worth checking out. And he sold me because it seemed to have a slightly more thematic grip on what I would be often another Euro be cube pushing, you know, the sort of sensory spice road of you take this cube, you turn it into a different number, different color cube, you turn it into different color cube points. Well, in the Scholars of the South Tigris, what you're doing is you're translating works of great wisdom. And so you have to care about whether or not you have translators that can translate, for example, Greek to Arabic or Aramaic to Hebrew or what have you. And you're translating these works back to Arabic so they can be included in your library. I'm like, that sounds like a really, really good thematic hook for what is otherwise a very procedural and dry mechanistic conversion. And I'm a big fan of the historical trappings. Now, Scholars of the South Tigris, when compared to, I'm just going to alternate between different pronunciations now every time. If I can find a third way to say it, I'll work that into the mix. Is much cleaner than a lot of Garfield games. You have commented in the past, Walker, in particular, that they have, at least it's a consistent set of iconography, but oh my goodness, there are a lot of them, and they like making lots and lots of really tiny icons all over the place. That is not the case for Scholars of the South Hagalaz, because there's only effectively two kinds of currency, gold and money. And the rest of it is about shoveling influence around and doing other kinds of things. Now, it's not especially clean as far as euros go. It's relatively clean for a medium-heavy euro. But in terms of the iconography, it's much more manageable, at least in and especially as far as the currency is concerned. It doesn't hang together in a particularly satisfying way, I don't think. You asked rhetorically, what about this is fun?
Oh, true enough.
And it did indeed feel very mechanical. And usually pretty reactive. It was a function of it's got an action selection mechanism where more or less every round-ish, it doesn't really have a round structure, but every round-ish you do on action, and so you can't really specialize at anything. And so you look and say, okay, well, I can translate or I can go get another scroll. Oh, there's room for another scroll and I get a bonanza. Okay, fine. And consequently, I didn't feel like I was building much towards anything. You were just doing a little scattering of a little bit over here, a little bit over there. So what I was hoping for, a slightly better theming and a slightly better conceit to offer a slightly more cohesive experience, it didn't manifest. I didn't strongly dislike it the way I have other Garfield games. It didn't feel quite as painfully as generic as some of the Euros of its ilk. But frankly, I found that it was very procedural and mechanical and not especially satisfying.
Yeah, a lot of moving around. Card goes here, then the card goes over here, and then the card goes over there.
Yeah.
And then you can take that card and move it somewhere else. It was, yeah.
And a very similar card-driven action mechanism, for what it's worth, can be found in Autobahn. And Autobahn, I think, is a much, much better example of the genre. And so that similarity didn't help it either. It's not over long. It's not overly complicated. But there's not really a whole bunch to motivate me to come back. It was fine. It was fine. That having been said, it was probably my favorite Garfield game. So, Scholars of the South Tigris, designed by S.J. McDonald and Shem Phillips, published by Garfield Games, 2023.
So we got to play Dogs of War, designed by Paul Morey, and there's a little side story, because I didn't put it in the news, but anyway, they say they're putting out Ethnos again, an actual named Ethnos reprint.
Yep.
As opposed to Archaeo Society, which I guess was not an Ethnos reprint, but anyway.
And what are they doing with the reprint, Walker? What's the theme of the reprint of Ethnos, Walker? What are they doing with it, Walker?
I don't know. I'm so uninterested that I didn't really look into it.
Anthropomorphic pandas,
oh,
Walker.
Oh, yes, you'll love that, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, it started out as a bit of a joke, but I think it's really getting to be a bit of a problem now. Just the sheer volume, and it's not stopping. Sometimes there's a little trend because by accident, a couple of publishers are responding to the same market forces and there's a brief glut. That was like 3 years ago. When are we getting to the other side of this?
Who knows?
It's
what sells, Mark.
Apparently, I am not representative of the broader market in that I'm totally sick of it.
We can hope that Dogs of War will be reprinted and they'll take the name.
They're obviously going to make them dogs, yeah.
And because it's called Dogs of War, obviously there'll be anthropomorphic dogs
Yeah, because just to stress, in the game Dogs of War, there are zero anthropomorphic animals. This is clearly a mistake that we rectified when and if it ever finally reprinted.
So I'm just saying, why haven't they reprinted this game? Because it is just as good, if not better, than Ethnos.
Oh, I definitely prefer Dogs of War to Ethnos.
I agree.
Ethnos is, to borrow a Walker phrase, it is very good for what it is. But I think that Dogs of War has much more quality player interaction and is just much more dynamic than Ethnoth. Ethnoth is sort of a slow build-up, whereas Dogs of War is got a great sense of dynamism and back and forth.
So you're trying to manipulate influence in all these different houses, and you have a special card, and you're obtaining shield tokens, which also influence.
It's a stock mechanism, yeah.
And then you are adding troops to different sides of a fight between two of the houses, and then whoever wins goes up on the track, which makes them worth more points, but also gets you some money depending. You put out a leader and you play a card, you're getting more cards, you're getting better leaders, you're getting some money. And so you sort of have to figure out how much money you're going to want. You want to steal those spaces early, or you're going to come back next round with a smaller force because you didn't get quite as much money. Anyway, lots to think about, lots of different cards, ways to upgrade cards. Everything about Dogs of War I very much enjoy. If you ever have a chance to try it and enjoy fancy hats, because, oh my God, fancy hats.
All the worker pieces are represented by these plastic busts, and it's just this incredibly faux Renaissance steampunk fantasy style with incredibly elaborate headwear. It's wild, and it looks different from a lot of other products. Even the ones that try to be steampunk, it still has its own unique sense of visuals. And again, in a market that is dominated by a whole bunch of recurring visual themes, it is one of the many things that I love about Dogs of War.
That is Dogs of War by Paolo Mori.
Now, I will say, as per usual, we played by the designer's suggested house rules that change a little bit about how crushing victories are resolved, and it actually locks down a battle once it hits 15. Now, this was the first time we'd ever played with those variants where I saw the potential for weirdness. I'm not going to say that it led to the game's detriment at all. I still think the game is better with those variants than without. But we saw a very, very high money game for a variety of reasons, some partially because of the powers and partially because of people's focus. And so consequently, there were lots of high-value war machines that got out, which let people lock battles down earlier. Consequently, in one round, people were forced to pass because there were no spaces left to play. However, that was the minority, and even in other rounds where the available options felt a little more constrained because people had jumped in early to lock down a battle track, I don't think that the game suffered in those contexts, but I could see it leading to a dynamic that some people might prefer to avoid, suffice to say. So if you've played Dogs of War by the rules as published, I highly recommend giving the variant rules a try. But if you have misgivings about the variant rules, I'd still suggest you give it a shot, but I could understand why you might want to go back to the rules as published, at least in some contexts. We played Crossbows and Catapults. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is by Stephen Baker, Noah Cohen, Rob Davio, Justin D. Davidson, and Brian Neff at Restoration Games. We got the Kickstarter all-in Fortress War version with extra weapons and extra toys and extra mercenaries. And I can definitely say that we profited from that, because this is a redo of a 1983 original where you first build up your little fortress with plastic blocks. They're not like Lego. They don't adhere together particularly strongly, but that's kind of the point, because you're going to try to bust it down. And then you place your figures, and there are rules for placing your figures. And then you get crossbows, you get some catapults. If you have the Kickstarter bonuses, you also have a ballista and a trebuchet. Actually, Dr. Contra this morning just asked, what's the difference between a catapult and a trebuchet? And I said, well, I have these visual aids. I can show you. A catapult is driven by tension, whereas a trebuchet is driven by a counterweight. See this little plastic counterweight? It's not really a counterweight. It's still driven by tension. But anyway, you get the point. And so that was helpful. Now, I will note, just as a passing mention, something that has caused a fair bit of consternation online is that the rules are a little vague, even by the standards of a toy that you're going to be playing with. For example, there are no rules about how to use the ballista or the trebuchet. We just used them. I mean, it wasn't really all that complicated, but there were some instances where, like, we're not 100% sure how this works, and we kind of muddled our way through, which we're willing to do in the context of a toy where you're shooting plastic discs at your opponent's castles. What did you think of Crossbows and Catapults?
I thought it was great. I don't know how the old game worked, but I love the fact that there was sort of a decision to make, because you win by taking out all of your opponent's figures, and there could be some behind the wall, and there could be some in front. But destroying your opponent's castle is not overly important until you realize that there are some cards in his deck that specifically reference parts of the castle. So there is also a reason to bring down the castle as well, not only because their leader is probably still behind there, and they could waste actions to move other units in behind the walls as well, but you must always shoot from at least one unit. So you can't have everyone hiding behind the walls unless you want to make nothing but catapult shots, which is probably a mistake.
Yes.
Because I think we found that most of the damage was from the two different ballistas.
Well, it depends. It's interesting. There's actually more game in crossbows and catapults than initially meets the eye, because you start by setting out these flags to delineate what side of the battlefield is yours. And I confess, I was too enamored with the toy factor and just playing around with shooting things. And I realized, wait a minute, I can move my troops up to the middle line of the board. And these crossbows that are a little bit too weak, now I can just shoot from much closer. That's really cool. And so it wasn't just that the game allowed for a little bit more tactical positioning than I might have otherwise thought, but it played into the physical design of the toy itself to make it more effective. Now, I was also initially concerned after I made that realization. I'm like, well, but you only have two actions on your turn, and spending one to move feels like a bit of a waste when you can just be shooting more often. But in the Kickstarter version, and this is one of those cases where I think, sadly, a lot of the best stuff is buried in the Kickstarter version, there are these mercenary cards that let you deploy extra troops, and they give you bonus actions. And suddenly, when you have bonus move actions, things get a lot more interesting, and you can really press the advantage, and then suddenly you have a mercenary that can go further than halfway down the table, and suddenly they're right in your face, and now your opponent is stuck with this choice. Do I murder this guy who's right in front of me, or do I continue the assault on the actual castle itself, because it's very unlikely that I'm going to be able to do a shot that does both. So the fact that we were engaged in any of these considerations is a testament to the fact that crossbows and catapults is actually more robust than it looks. Yes, you get to play with plastic blocks. Yes, you get to build your little thing and then shoot things across the table. All of that is great, but on top of that, there's also some interesting card play and positioning going on. It's not the deepest thing in the world, obviously, but it's far more than it initially appears. And it's a little tragic, I think, that some of that cool stuff is buried in the Kickstarter version.
Agreed. Also too bad that the Dwarven Fortress is completely impregnable and will never fall. That's also unfortunate.
Yeah, so I did... Well, it's weird, because this leads to actually one of my criticisms of crossbows and catapults, because, as you say, destroying the castle is just a means to an end, right? And yes, I wasted far too many actions hitting that same section of your castle, and the wall nudged, and then it buckled, and then it kind of cratered, but never did anything fall. And so it was interesting. It was kind of cool to see that. And it was very much in keeping with the playtime. But the problem is that the victory condition is to knock over all of your opponent's figures. And to a certain extent, I felt this way about Flipships, for example. A bit of a stretch, but Kane Klinko's Flipships was a cooperative dexterity game where you flip these cardboard tokens that represent ships and you're shooting down enemy ships, and all that part was fine. But it culminated in a boss battle that required you to do a very specific thing, which was flip your ship into a sort of cardboard arrangement that was farther down the table. And my issue was that I enjoyed playing the game up to that point, but when the game narrowed to just do this one specific thing, it was A, too difficult, and B, too constrained. In the context of crossbows and catapults, the one thing is knock over enemy figures, usually by a crossbow. I mean, you can do it by catapult, but that's probably asking for trouble. And that specific task, I did not find nearly as fun as the early stages where you've got this castle to knock down and there's all this other stuff to think about. And so another victory condition, or somehow making castle destruction part of it or something, would make me happier, because by the time we got to the very, very end of crossbows and catapults, it was starting to wear out its welcome for me, because it was all about, as I say, can you knock over a figure with a crossbow? Yes or no? If no, you're not getting anywhere, and you don't have anything else fun to do. And so that was where I felt the game narrowed to a point that was unpleasant for me.
Agreed. That is Crossbows and Catapults, a review copy from Restoration Games.
Bonus catapult addendum now. The other catapult-based dexterity toy fortress-building game is Catapult Feud. I have the earlier edition called Catapult Kingdoms, but it is now called Catapult Feud, and it is by Vesuvius Media, designed by Christian Foch, and it too involves plastic catapults and building up your little castle. It is very different in scope. One of the great things about crossbows and catapults that I'll emphasize is that it fits on a table. Not any table. You need a table of reasonable size, but it'll fit on a table. Catapult Feud is designed to be played on a floor or a huge table. The recommended distance between your two castles is 1.5 meters. My table is pretty big and was perfect for crossbows and catapults. There was even extra room for crossbows and catapults, but it was too small for Catapult Feud. On top of that, Catapult Feud only has the aforementioned catapults. They do, however, I will say, they launch these glorious black squishy boulders. It's marvelous. Both of these games, by the way, it's worth stressing, you cannot play in a basement with lots of surfaces that you can't look under. So, for example, one of the reasons why it took us so long to get to try some of these dexterity games is because most frequently we play in Historic Swag Studios, which has a lot of nooks and crannies and pieces will go get missing. This is not going to stay on your table. There are going to be pieces bouncing all over the place. So we had to play it in my dining room, which is better lit and has less places for things to hide. Catapult Feud has the advantage over crossbows and catapults in that the figures that you want to knock over are much bigger. I would be very much in favor of trying to source alternate dwarf and or orc miniatures. Maybe Heroescape figures, I don't know. Something a little bit bigger to make it a little bit easier to start headhunting. It would bring the game to a faster conclusion, as well as address some of my issues about the narrowness of the scope of victory conditions. The Catapult Feud was just less interesting overall, which is to be expected. It's a small box, constrained experience. The biggest problem with Catapult Feud, and indeed this is something that's worth emphasizing about the quality of crossbows and catapults, was that in Catapult Feud, the catapults aren't terribly well designed. I felt that they weren't strong enough for the distance that the game tells you to set up. Like, the little rock wouldn't overshoot. It would always just kind of meh and then sort of like roll into the opponent's castle, which is fine, but it makes me feel like I'm not engaged in any interesting catapult thing. In crossbows and catapults, the crossbows work differently from the catapults, which work differently from the trebuchet, which work differently from... And so you get to get a little bit of system mastery over the course of a single game, which is great. And on top of that, and this is perhaps unforgivable, I think, in Catapult Feud, manufacturing quirks caused the catapults to just fire differently. The two catapults in my base game feel very, very different from each other. I did not notice that in terms of the different crossbows and the different catapults and crossbows and catapults. Maybe I just got lucky. Maybe there are other copies where that won't work. But if you're going to be designing a game like this, your toy manufacturing has to be on point. And if I start feeling like the physical implementation is getting in the way of my fun, that's a problem. And I felt that for Catapult Feud, which is a shame because a lot of it's charming. And as I say, I prefer some of the components. But overall, it just couldn't cohere because I wasn't having fun with the catapults. So that is your bonus addendum catapult comparison. We seek to be comprehensive here about our toy play.
That's right. I agree. 51st State just recently came on Board Game Arena. And unfortunately, it is a nightmare at async play. I'm sure it would be fine if you're playing it in real life, in like actual time. But I really wanted to get back to the table with real people and real cards because I love 51st State. And I haven't even got, they came out with an ultimate edition recently and obviously it has not even been on my table. So I just had it downstairs and it was immediately picked by Louie. So I was happy to oblige. And 51st State is just great. It's got that sort of Gaia Project, get a good pool of resources, stay in the round longer type feel. You're attacking the other players. They get a good combo going. You need to stop that immediately or else they're going to outscore you. Whoever gets 25 ends the game. And then whoever has the most at the end. So if they get a good scoring mechanism going without you stopping it, there's no way to slow them down. It is very grindy in a good way. I like everything about 51st State, and I'm glad I got it back to the table. Post-apocalyptic, different levels, rebuilding ruins. I love it.
And a series of interesting expansions.
Yes. Lots of expansions. Which, a lot of them are just more cards. A lot of them are like completely new mechanisms that will change the game up. 51st State by Nancy Trevicek and put out by Portal Games. Also brought Ceres back to the table. It was another giant crowdfunding type game where has a very interesting sort of worker placement game. Everyone has 5 workers that you're going to put out on the main board. But then there was a pool of sort of astronauts of varying colors that you need to engage your tableau. And so there's this interesting sort of decision. Do I want to take these spots on the board before anyone can get them? Or do I need to get to these astronauts before all the red ones disappear? So it's an interesting sort of timing mechanism. When to take actions, when to take the astronauts, and building up your tableau so, you know, the pool of astronauts sort of reflects what colors are there. You're sending out these probes, like this big turning sort of orbiting thing has like three rings and they all spin. So, you know, it refreshes and you're sending out these satellites to get you better resources and you have scoring cards. Lots going on. If you have a chance to try it, I definitely would. It's a series designed by Gustav Sundström and put out by Atypia Games. So Last Aurora, we played a long time ago, and it has a Kickstarter out now.
Long time ago.
So seeing as the Kickstarter was coming out, I wanted to get back to the table just to try to remember, is this something I want to continue? Do I have enough in this one box? Do I really need this extra stuff? Apparently there was another sort of Kickstarter beforehand. They brought out like sort of a second edition with Frostlands that changed some stuff. So I'm going to have to look into that more because I need to know if the combat has changed. Because we talked afterwards. We enjoy everything in Last Aurora. It has this interesting sort of, you have this convoy. You're trying to get to the coast before this big cargo ship leaves. They're going to take you south because it's another post-apocalyptic Arctic sort of situation. And then all these scavengers are attacking you. You're building up your caravan with these interesting sort of cargo bits that do all sorts of different things. You get to mount weapons on them. You're picking up all these different, you know, passengers that give you abilities. And so you're sending the passengers out to, you know, help pick up stuff. And depending on their strength, it lets you go to different worker placement spots. Love that part. Love the racing part. Hate the combat. The combat is borderline terrible because not only is it like random card draw, if you're just going to miss or do instant damage. But on top of that, it's like once the enemy is destroyed, you flip a card, and depending on where you place your damage token, like in the order, like say if I damage them first and then some other people damage them,
yeah,
depending on where that token is, that's who's going to get the benefit, which is completely random again. And it's just, and I think it helped because I reread the rules and I just started with that when we started the game. It's like, this is combat. Disregard it. Like, we need to do it, but disregard the outcome and how it works. It's just something we have to deal with.
Right.
And I think everyone enjoyed it. The art is great. This whole premise is very interesting. I really like Last Aurora. I'm not sure. They have announced that they're now going to have an upgrade pack, so I might look into that. But as for just getting more stuff, there's so much already stuff in the box that I don't think there needs to be more of it. But if there's sort of updated combat rules or something like that, I'll definitely be in for that. That is Last Aurora, designed by Mauro Cerbato and put out by Pendragon Game Studio.
Those are the games we've been playing over the past couple weeks. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
So I talk a lot about Barony.
Yep.
It was a great game that came out. It is now on Kickstarter. It's called the Royal Edition. It comes automatically with the Sorcery expansion that came out that is usually hard to get. They're not going to be changing the rules up. It's also going to come with, thankfully, also another one that has a sort of upgrade pack because, you know, this Royal Edition has two layered board marks.
Ooh.
And of course, people were outraged that, well, I have the old copy. I would like these two. So there'll be an upgrade pack.
Good for them.
We'll get you the new pieces and you can get the Sorcery expansion included. I looked at it. Maybe it could be the scenario where, you know, I already have one. Mine's better. But,
right.
But I'm not really fond of the meeples they have in this one because they're sort of screen printed, whereas the ones that came in the old box are sort of like double layered wooden castles. I just prefer the ones that are in my box. So I'm more than happy to get the upgrade pack. And you can also get this hero expansion that, you know, gives everyone asymmetric powers. That might be interesting. Anyway, if you want to check out Barony, oh, yeah, and there's this idiot that does a video, you know, you scroll down.
Yep.
And they had this buffoon.
A jabroni.
On the Dice Tower years ago.
Yep.
And so he did a video and they put
whatever happened to him.
I don't know.
Yeah. One of those hack shills that
flash in the pan.
Yeah.
One of those guys. And Mark Smurf, I'll just do all the crowdfunding stuff. Smurf's role-playing game. I'm into fun, silly stuff like that. I highly doubt I will just even get the base thing, but just the fact that someone's made a Smurf role-playing game makes me a little fun inside. I like it.
So to continue on the trend of too many anthropomorphic animals, especially as far as rethemes are concerned, there are two Reiner Knizia games that are being republished now with anthropomorphic animal themes. One of them is a redo of his card auction game Money, which I think is very underrated. As far as auction fillers go, it's very good and quite well done, and it's got some novel scoring involved. So now it's going to be a whole bunch of cats and dogs and other things engaged in currency trading, because of course that's what makes sense. And then I'm going to give them half a pass on this other one. This is going to be a reprint of the auction game Orongo, which was about Moai and Easter Island and a whole bunch of other things. So again, this is one of the virtues of anthropomorphic animals. If you do it with anthropomorphic animals, you have to worry less about colonialism, and you don't have to do the same old tired colonialist themes. Okay, fine, whatever. And so this is instead going to be about cat-based gangsters in Japan, and it is called Nyakuza.
Well, that tracks.
Which absolutely tracks. So maybe we're going to trade in colonialism for a little bit of Orientalism. Who knows? I don't remember Orongo being especially spectacular, but Reiner Knizia auction games are always for the good. Nyakuza.
So back in the old times, Games Workshop, Andy Chambers, Gav Thorpe, Dan Morrison, sort of the people that made it all happen, are now putting out another miniature skirmish game. It's going to be called Zeogenesis, a scalable skirmish game by Best Hobby. So I'm very much going to keep a track on this. It looks like it's going to be great.
Yeah, by scalable, they basically mean that you pick a certain number of mechs, and every mech has a retinue attached to it. And so you don't build based on points. You just say, okay, well, we're playing a one mech game or a two mech game or a three mech game. And that's how it scales. I'm always dubious because every tabletop miniatures rule system always underestimates how long it takes to play. They're like, oh, yeah, play out a quick skirmish in 30 minutes, and then 2 hours later, which is fine. Don't get me wrong. 2 hours is an appropriate length of time for a tabletop miniatures game, but I'm very curious about how the conceit manifests itself.
Another game that's going to be out on crowdfunding soon is called Plain Pita, Mark. It is a sort of scaled-down Crokino game, except, and it's like sort of alien-based. But there are magnets inside not only the discs that you flick, but also in the board itself. So you flick these discs, and they might flip to the other side, which changes scoring. It just looks like it's going to be a great, fun, dexterity-type game called Plain Pita.
More magnets.
Yes, magnets just make things better. We've already found this out. It's been proven true.
It's an established fact.
Exactly. And lastly for me, Keep the Heroes Out. I already talked about that they're putting out a digital version of Keep the Heroes Out. It was supposed to be coming to crowdfunding soon. They had pictures of physical components that you could also get for your games, but they ran into some problem with the previous Kickstarter. See, there was a Russian localized sort of distributor had an agreement, and it was terminated. The localizing publisher made a crowdfunding campaign on their website in such a way that it was regionally locked. And during the campaign, they offered the game at prices and bundles that they were not allowed to have made in the first place, breaching their contract of their publisher thing. So there's all stories going back and forth. I'm not going to be the sleuth Sherlock Holmes that looks into who's telling the truth and who's not.
Right.
Long story short, he's decided to push back the campaign for the digital game. And for some reason, the physical components are now not even on the preview page anymore. So I'm not, hopefully that has not been cut out. And we can hope that we will get Keep the Heroes Out digital game soon.
And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We apologize for the week's delay, but thank you so much for your patience. Please do take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby time. And as always, thank you, Rules Explainer. Speak the truth. Protect the vulnerable.
Peace.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.